Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 11, titled Storia Americana. This is the finale of Season 4, and there's a lot of death, just like there's been throughout the whole season. And it's the death of the season. Aaron, what do you think?
To paraphrase George W. Bush on leaving Donald J. Trump's inauguration in 2017. That was some weird shit. This is a lot. I mean, yeah, this felt, I saw a lot of people on Twitter, adding me about what a terrible experience this was watching. Cause it's essentially a 30-minute episode. Like the credits are extended. There's if you missed it, there's actually a brief post-credit, sequence. If you take all that stuff out, like this is essentially a 30-minute episode. It was an hour of television. That means you had 50-50 commercials to content, pretty much.
Yikes.
And I could even tell, like even watching on FX on Hulu, you could see like where, holy hell, there was a 3-minute scene of just people reacting to Satchel coming back to life, which is a wonderful scene. But like it's literally 3 minutes of that and then cut to another commercial break. And I imagine like it must have been a frustrating experience to watch it live on FX. But yeah, like I have a very strong feeling that this show kind of lost steam right around, you know, the gang war, when the gang war should have heated up with the death of Senator, Dr. Senator. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of didn't really have any way to go, where to go, except for the Wizard of Oz episode that they clearly had built up around, and then kind of didn't know what to do with itself after that. You know, like I've said before, I admire Holly for going for something, like going for this kind of big story, this non-conventional story, the story of like America and immigration and racial relations seen through the lens of this 1950s Midwestern gang war. I think it's really cool what he's trying to go for. But like this cake just didn't quite come together for me. And I'm not saying it's terrible, you know, like it's this. I still enjoyed watching this season. I still enjoyed a lot of performances. I enjoyed a lot of the theses behind this. It's just, you know, so what I was worried about when I started talking about this thing being a morality play, like, you know, the whole point of doing a morality play is to try to teach something, someone about the world, try to change their mind. And if you don't have enough there to attract people in to watch it, then, you know, despite the brilliance of everything else you do, you've kind of failed. And I feel like by failing to make the actual war, you know, that's the sizzle, you know, the steak is the complicated racial relations and what it means to be an American and immigration and all that kind of stuff. If you don't have the sizzle, no one cares a shit about the steak. And, you know, I think that's the problem with Fargo season four. It's just the thing it was ostensibly about, the thing that's supposed to lure people in, just there wasn't much there. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, I think I'm with you. I didn't like much about this finale. I've progressively liked the season less as it's gone on. And I think it's because it maybe felt like it had a message it was trying to tell us, and it told us pretty early on. Like I'm trying to think, like this credit card stuff that Loy had going was dated way back to the beginning of this season. Effectively in the opening scenes of this mm-hmm. season, it tells us everything we need to know about like the melting pot that is America. And maybe it's just because I largely agree with the thesis of this season that I'm, you know, taking that away immediately from, oh yeah, this is where they're going with this and this is what it's doing.
Right.
I think mostly it's a success, in that regard, more than it is a success in entertaining me or engaging me on like an emotional level. It's a much more like intellectual season of Fargo mm-hmm. than I'm used to seeing. And in that, it doesn't entirely work either. Cause every other season, I feel like I was entertained the entire time. I was not like sort of looking at my watch saying, oh yeah, this is a 30-minute episode and they're using 15 minutes of it on this assassination scene that I don't even think is believable in the first place. There's just a lot of stuff in there that it just didn't work for me. It really didn't. Yeah. Although I like what they were trying to do. I think it's hugely ambitious. It's a tough thing to do with that overarching message for the entire season. And they get around to it. Like that speech from Ebel, I think the best scene in this episode is that Ebel telling Loy how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And Loy just going, oh, yeah, no, this didn't even cross my mind. Like, I thought I was going to be the king of Kansas City, and here I am. I'm just another cog in this conglomerate now, you know? And knowing where this story goes in Kansas City over the next 30 years, 20 years, whatever, where Mike Milligan ends up working in the Kansas City Mafia, all that stuff works. It makes sense. It's just like the pieces that they put together to get there did not entertain me at all.
Yeah. And I think it goes down. There's a lot of things. Like, I think, like I said, I think people persuaded me about what he was trying to do with the casting, the stunt casting, the comic characters as these mob bosses. And I understand that. And I understand some of the other stuff he was trying to do. It's just like you said, it just didn't quite come together for me. Like, it's, that central arc of like Loy being clearly the best person. Like that's one of the things that I had, was very little drama in the season. I knew there's no way that any of these fools could beat Loy Cannon. He was too smart, too resourceful, too organized, too decent. The only way he'd be beat is by the system itself. And that's essentially what happened, you know, like, it's the same way that like what Ebel was saying to Loy is the same thing you could say to a Native American back in the 15th century. It's like, you can burn this particular boat and you can kill everyone aboard and you can resist that. But you know what? There's going to be three more boats tomorrow and there's going to be three more boats tomorrow and there's going to be three. And there's nothing. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
It's inevitable that you could do every, you can make all the right plays, but you're just, you know, you're a couple years late on the tech tree and you're going to get run off your own continent. That's a very unsatisfying, like melancholy story to tell. And it's a tough thing to kind of live with, you know. And I there's a couple points where I thought like, oh, they're going to do something interesting with like, you know, like, well, Loy lost half his business, but he gained 100% of his family. And I was thinking like, you know, this might be like a better version of American Gangster, because like Denzel walks out of that movie alive, but he loses like 20 years in prison, like the best years and some of his best year of his life and his family and all that kind of stuff. And I, just as I was formulating that thought, it's like, huh, this is kind of like a slightly happier American Gangster. There's El Mayor with the choo, choo, choo. And I'm like, well, fuck me. So like I said, there's a lot of stuff thing I think is interesting, but also, like, I've read the True Hollywood Reporter. I've read the IndieWire interviews. There's a couple of these things. I don't think there's a couple of these interviews have already started bubbling forth. And it does feel like Holly had something he was going to do. Like, something in the finale wasn't working. He had to take, like, 20 minutes out of it. And then it's like, oh, geez, what do I do? I got to start. That's where the Stitch Together episode came from. Like, all this, you know, were things that didn't quite work and he tried to fix it in editing and then he had a bunch of time to tinker with it and it just still, I don't think, still came quite together. But, you know, it also, I don't think this season is as terrible as, like, people are making out to be on Reddit, on some of the, you know, it seems like the season is kind of divided the subreddit, sometimes that happens. And it's weird because, same thing happened season 3. It feels like Fargo is getting a little bit more surreal and cerebral as the seasons go on, as that's the thing that kind of interests Holly, doing, you know, weird conceptual shit.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like the you know, thesis behind the season is this big conceptual thing, but then I feel like so much of the action, so much of the actual happenings in this season have been almost too grounded in a weird way. Like, you know, aside from like the fart attack and the, you know, Gaetano blowing his head off accidentally, like, I was incredibly disappointed by Orietta's death, by Mayflower's death. It's so fucking mundane. It's just, she got shot in the head. She's an angel of death. You don't get to shoot an angel of death in the head and say that's the end of her story.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like
they didn't earn that imagery, that angel of death imagery, right, by the end. They retroactively unearned it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they were setting her up to be this kind of unstoppable evil force, and then they also had another unstoppable evil force and the actual unstoppable evil ghost.
Which was extremely confusing to me most of the time.
You don't see Lorne Malvo going out like, no, you know, that. But I don't know.
I mean, you can fight him, but you didn't kill him, right?
I thought it was interesting. I don't know. It might be commentary in Holly about like Lorne Malvo, there's always a bigger fish, right? You know, she's the angel of death, but then, you know, this 17th century slave captain is the real fucking angel of death, and he's the one. And if you missed it, you know, Mr. Snowman was in that scene. Right. It's something that you got to kind of look for. And we'll talk about that in context. Maybe we should do that. Maybe we should just start talking about the episode, because I feel like, geez, there's only like 30 minutes of stuff to talk about. We're about to tread all over it.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So Story Americana, this is all like, you're supposed to understand this is Ethel Reeta's history report. And since it's a short episode, I only had a page and a half of notes. I thought we could just consider it scene by scene.
Okay.
We got this long montage to begin with, which I thought was very effectively set against Johnny Cash's What Is Man Lord, where he's essentially quoting Psalms chapter 8 about like, you know, why us? Why are we, why are we these insignificant beings, you know, put over dominion of this planet? Why are we allowed to run things? And you just all this chaos that's going on in the montage, especially with Giusto. Giusto's going full on Gaetano crazy.
Yeah.
Smashing shit, getting drunk. There's also a backdrop of Loy meeting with Evil in the park. Him handing over the ring. This was like widely held theory that this was going to be Loy's last ditch effort to kind of manipulate, you know, to tell this false story about Giusto betraying the family.
And it works.
He says, get your house in order. We can, and it works really well because everything circumstantially kind of clicks into place against Giusto. He gives up his hostage, Zero. That's kind of nice. All of the kids made it out of the season. I'm not going to say all right.
Yeah.
But they made out of the season alive, and Zero's smiling because he had a pretty good experience with the Cannon family. Giusto takes...
The montage there also includes like the faces of all the people who've died over the course of this season with, you know, Antoon and Calamita and all these guys. So you kind of... They're setting up, what is the cost of all of this, right?
Yeah, losing Dr. Senator. Mm-hmm. Giusto takes Dr. Fucko hostage, throws him in the back of a car with his father-in-law, the alderman / mayor candidate, shoots them both in the head, well, all over the place with a Tommy gun out in the country, burns their bodies. And this is all insane. As I'm watching this, I'm like, well, you can't commit this kind of crime and get away with it. But it doesn't matter because he's not going to be breathing for more than 15 minutes.
Right.
You know, Mayflower sitting there in lonely in a prison cell. She makes bail. Happy is in the cafe regaling people of stories of his criminal adventures. Everything's looking against. I briefly thought that maybe something was going to happen here, like and subvert what I thought was going to happen because. You know, I thought like, oh, well, maybe Evil's going to betray them both. Like, you know, we're going to take care of Happy because we don't want them around. We're going to take care of Loy because Leon's sneaking up behind him with the gun. Mm-hmm. But there's this, I thought, pretty cool Godfather setting where Loy essentially takes care of all family business. You know, yeah. he crushes Giusto. He takes out Leon. He takes out Happy. And Holly just makes a meal out of it. He's going for broke with the slow motion gunfire, a 2 minute long strangulation of Leon, which was fairly satisfying.
Yeah, I like those parts.
Yeah. And then they trap Giusto by saying, hey, we won. We got Loy. You got to come out and celebrate with us. And he gets put on trial by La Familia.
I hate this scene. I hate this scene, and I hate the ride to the country, and I hate the assassinations. All of it's bad. All of it is so not gangster shit.
Let's talk about the first
that
scene. Have
you ever seen an Italian gangster movie? They don't drag you out in front of the group.
I've seen a few, actually.
Well, I'm more talking to Noah Hawley. Have you ever seen an Italian gangster movie, Mr. Hawley? Because they don't do this. They don't pull you out in front of the group and say, here's what you've been accused of. Can you defend yourself with words? No. They put you in a car. Everybody's smiling. They drive out to the country, say, hey, yeah, we're meeting this guy. We got to do this thing. They either put a bullet in your head immediately when you drive off, or they get out to the countryside, you step out of the car, and they whack you. That's how this goes.
And I thought they were setting that up with like the perfect execution of like, hey, boss, everything's cool. Come on out and celebrate with us. Pop, pop, pop.
They do. Yeah, they set it up. They just never knock it down.
The thing is like, I 100% agree with you, but I'm kind of cutting some slack because I don't think I've ever seen a mafia don whacked in a movie before. Like Vito Corleone, I mean, I saw an attempted whacking, which he's just out and getting the... So it's like it didn't... Yeah, I mean, I guess that's right. It's like they didn't call the heads of the five families together and then, you know, put Vito on trial and blow his brains, right?
Yeah, it's just not how it goes. They decide, they make up their minds, oh, okay, this guy's got to go, and they go. That's it.
Yeah. And it's like also frustrating because I don't take Giusto seriously. And here, finally, the family's not taking him seriously, but he's still trying to act like he's got, you know, some kind of sway or some kind of power. He tries to order them to stop the process, which is interesting, I guess, in context of some things going on in the real world right now. But Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if we need to walk it through for people, but the plan here is just like, oh, we got the ring that connects to the nurse. They grab the nurse. The nurse tells her truth. Like, you know, mm-hmm. this goes back to, like, I knew this was going to come in, that this misunderstanding. And I'm not even sure if it's a misunderstanding, but, you know, Joss was trying to play it off. But, you know, it looks real bad when your brother dies under really mysterious circumstances. Yeah. And the woman that you've been shtipping for several months and having hot kinky sex with is the one that murdered your father, and you've kind of been mismanaging this whole thing anyway. So a lot of this is just we got a piece of feedback where it's like, did we think that the mafia's case against someone is thin? And I'm like, you know, like you said, it's like, have you seen a mafia movie? Like, better safe than sorry is the rule of the day. Like, and there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. This isn't a court of law.
Plus this is coming down from the heads, right, in New York. This is not like Ebel just decided to do this himself and then all these guys got behind him.
Right.
This is coming from the real power behind the throne, the guy behind him, right, as he says later on.
Yeah. And they do this, you know, this is a family business, such an old world way to do things. This is the new world. And I'm like, so this is, you're supposed to understand this is the start of the thing that Mike Milligan is going to be a part of in the 70s, the syndicate.
Yep.
This corporatized crime franchise, essentially, that you don't have people that run, you know, empires. You have people that own a McDonald's franchise.
Right.
And if they want to stop paying their franchise fees, guess what? There's three people lined up behind them that want a franchise, and the McDonald's can get rid of you and put someone else in there and still be fucking making money on Ronald McDonald.
This is my favorite part of the episode. The best thing they did in this is just show how, that weird, like, corporatization of this crime underworld here is sort of also supported on the backs of, I don't know. It's this weird, like, who's keeping who down here, right? Because everybody's keeping everybody down. And then anybody who gets ahead is just stepping on the neck of the person below them. And then it's sort of reflected in a microcosm, like a more personal sort of thing with Loy Cannon's death, where he sold out Zalmer and Swanee, and that came back to bite him, like, personally. And, you know, all these little things that you do sort of add up to you getting fucked eventually by the guy who has more power than you. So,
that was one of the main themes of this season, according to Holly, is the past catching up with you.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can, it seems like things are smooth sailing and blue skies until you get to a certain point, and then the tornado comes.
And all that credit card stuff, you know, falls into that same theme. They did a pretty good job with that overarching theme. And just telling us, like, hey, this is what it is, you know.
And but the thing is like, this is all the connected to stamping, you know, which is, that's just very highly some. And that's the thing where sometimes this stuff just doesn't work on, you know, like Holly with Legion, when you would have these flights of fancies, you could always rationalize it. It was like, oh, well, this is happening on the astral plane. So who knows? Like, they're all dancing and stuff, but, like, they're probably really, this is intense psychic combat or some shit. But at this point, there's just some Italian dude stamping on the floor. And it worked really well in the pilot when it was kind of, like, literally a play about, like, you know, this history report that Ethelreda was working on. And you've got these guys coming to replace these guys, and these guys coming, everybody stamping. It's very highly theatrical. But we're a ways away from that, and we bring it all back. And I just, one of those things where I like I said, it kind of works, but it doesn't work as a gangster thing, you know?
Like, yeah, it doesn't work as well as
West Side Story doesn't work as a street gang story, but it works really well as a musical. You know what I mean?
Right,
and like
right.
Fargo, it's like, this might have worked really a lot better as a musical. Maybe you should have leaned way into Legion and just had everybody singing their lines and dancing around and whatnot. But it's just that I felt like there was a mismatch of form and function in a lot of the things here artistically.
I agree, and it's the first time they've really tried to branch out and do something this big, right? Like, right. I'm thinking of season 3, it has some ideas in it, and some supernatural elements that sort of reinforce those ideas, but ultimately, like, trying to do this season arc that says something about America, says something about humanity, is, like, kind of a little outside of this show's wheelhouse, I think, or at least I haven't picked up on those themes in previous seasons as heavily as this one. Mm-hmm. So, it's admirable to try, but like, didn't quite work.
So you got this fake gangster trial that leads to this gangster execution, and the car ride out is kind of like played as comedy, which another thing, it's like, I felt like the time for comedy was over, and there's this like them screaming hag, and it's like, you know, Al and Peg Bundy going at each other in the back seat, and the one, knock it off, you guys. And they're driving out to the battle hymn of the Republic, which, if you don't know, was an abolitionist song. It was a Union soldier kind of fighting song, comparing the deeds of Christ to what they were doing back at the time, you know, as Christ died to make men holy, let us die to make set men free, kind of thing, which I thought was a really cool juxtaposition. But then they get out there, and this is where the theme of the season juxtaposes against the actual thing that we're seeing, where Josto's begging for his life and saying, you know, he's essentially, this is the immigrant thing. It's like, you know, hey, we're all, and it's even bigger than that. Like, we all humans are connected. We're all literally brothers and sisters. We're all from the same tribe. And what's all this killing for? You know, what's it ever been? But it rings hollow because Josto's been responsible for a lot of the killing. Right. And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, we're all related and we forget that. For what? You know, we're climbing a ladder that doesn't go anywhere and you can't go side to side or up and down. And the guy, to his credit, is like, yeah, I'm not buying it.
It's like this self-serving reticate. What the fuck am I trying to say?
Rhetoric.
That's the word I'm looking
for. And there's a lot of this like stepping over each other, and everyone's doing it until it's your turn to be stepped on, and then it's like, hey, we can't be. And there's like some kind of thesis in there about like, so what's the remedy? You know, like, how do we break this cycle? I don't think Fargo has an idea on that. Doesn't seem like it.
I mean, you have to appeal to the better angels, right? But like, when those better angels are being, when you are taking those better angels' names in vain and using them for your own purposes, the better angels become powerless. And that's what this season is about.
Yeah. So he tries to talk himself out of the pit. It doesn't work. Mayflower has a final request, is for him for Josto to get shot so she can see it, which, she's a weird, creepy person to the end, and the way she kind of like stomps over to watch him bleed out is really interesting. And she gets this, she turns around, she gets this real dreamy look in her face, and this is the part where the snowman comes in, because she sees herself reflected in the mirror, and her face is all distorted, and in the lower left corner, I believe, is Mr. Snowman standing over her shoulder as the personification of death, as Holly explained him as like a endemic of your past catching up to you, which...
Okay.
Works in this scene, but I don't think it works as a understanding of a curse on the Smutney family, certainly. And then she gets shot, and then there's like this really sweet image, artistically sweet image of them dead in the pit, and they look like a happy couple running off into like, you know, like eloping or something, which I thought was interesting, but you know.
Yeah, I couldn't get to the imagery they were going for there, because the imagery in previous episodes was just completely incongruous with her death. But I don't know. And this whole, like, this, I didn't feel like any of this stuff worked, because I didn't feel that it was believable. I didn't feel like the endings lined up with, like, the stuff they had done before with those characters. It just didn't feel right. Like, Joe Buelow saying any last words. Like, okay, I get it. Maybe this is some, like, Fargo... or Coen Brothers reference, and you know, there's like No Country for Old Men in there with Josto begging for his life. But Joe, a gangster is not going to ask you if you have last words. They just don't do it.
Do you think this season was hurt by the fact that we had just gone on like a gangster binge, and like all of the Scorsese probably gangster lore was like right there at the fingertips, and we just seen like honestly, we did see a mafia don get hit, like Joe Pesci in Casino. Mm-hmm. That's the king of Las Vegas getting taken out, and it didn't look like this, not at all. So like I wonder if you know, it had been another year where we hadn't gone accidentally through a Scorsese anniversary binge over on the Bald Move Prestige podcast, if we some of this would we'd kind of just gone with it. Well, it's like, you know, it's not my gang type of gangster, but it's more egregious when you just see some of the finest gangster movies of all time.
Yeah.
And see how they stack up against.
For sure.
But yeah, I don't know. Is that why is Mr. Snowman there? Did he some did was Ethel Rita able to transfer the curse onto him? Was he actually a more of a you're supposed to understand a guardian angel? I
don't know.
Let's finally leave that stuff mysterious, I guess.
Yeah, he's been pretty confusing most of the season, and you know it helped to get the backstory a little bit. But I will, I guess, take since I don't have a clear read on it, I guess I'll take Mr. Hawley at his word. This sort of past catching up.
Ethel Rita's family gets out from underneath the canon thumb.
Yeah,
you know, she has. I still am not 100% sure why Loy lets her off the hook for this piece of information. Because again, I feel like a real gangster would just be like, "Oh, thanks for giving me that." It's the same way that McDonald's treats the guy that invents the chicken nuggets. Hey. Thanks for that $1 billion idea. Now get the fuck back to your cubicle in the basement. You know, like yeah. Do you understand the fact that I own you and I own all of your work output and any idea that comes out of your head is also mine because, oh, I own you. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Loy's, he's a different type of gangster. You know, he's got more of a code. Loy, for his part, gets to check out of the hotel, move back to his house, but he's horrified as his family is discovered a fact that apparently his house has been burgled. It's been broken into. The door's ajar. He goes and investigates with the gun and finds Satchel passed out on his childhood bed, and he's got a gun. And Loy, I think this scene worked really well just out of context. His parents just insane joy at the family being brought back together, that, you know, you've maybe lost a few things, but you've gained what's most important.
Yeah, I think it would have worked better as like a episode, the end of an episode where we had seen, you know, like more of Satchel. It was too out of context for me, or too like out of the emotional context. Because, you know, I'm in this gang war and I'm thinking about that. And we've only seen Satchel once in the last two episodes and it was brief. And I'm thinking, okay, he's gone. He's Mike Milligan. And then obviously you knew when the door was ajar that it was Satchel come back. But like the emotional context wasn't quite there for me. So I wasn't able to get into the scene as much as I wanted. Although I think it was a well shot and good scene.
I guess I didn't think it was... did not suspect it was Satchel. I really was thinking that, you know, like I thought it was weird that we saw Satchel last episode, and I was still thinking that, like, okay, we're not going to see Satchel again. So I was legitimately, I guess as soon as he went upstairs, like I'm like, oh, this must be Satchel. But my first thought is like that he was going to be betrayed by Evil and that organization, which is the next scene. Mm-hmm. Loy driving out to meet Evil. All's forgiven, back to business, but there's a few final details. Oh, we're taking half your business, and actually we're not taking half, we're leaving you half, because we could take everything if we wanted to. And it's just, you know, that bone wary feeling that people were talking about, like with Loy looking at the credit card idea that had been stolen and co-opted from him.
Yeah.
You know, this whiplash of thinking that you won, you're going to be the king of Kansas City, and now you're just, you know, a bag boy. And it something that I can't remember who pointed this out, if it was Seppenwall or the IndieWire reporter, but the fact that like Mike Milligan had a very similar arc in season two, that, you know, he did all this dirty work for his bosses. He thought he was going to get this rich reward. He ends up getting disrespected, demeaned, and sat at a desk job for his troubles. That this kind of cycle of like repeated history and how do you get out of it, I thought is potentially interesting to explore. But it felt bad.
That's why this is my favorite scene of the episode, because
it felt inevitable.
It does, yeah. It feels like such a huge betrayal, but one you should have seen coming, and from a character that I thought I liked and now I viscerally hate. The way they flip
Ebel really worked,
right there,
right?
Absolutely. They've turned Ebel into just this colossal asshole. when all season he's been this guy that I'm like, yeah, he's the level-headed one. He's the smart guy who can get things done.
If only he and Dr. Senator could have worked things out, everything right. would have been fine, right?
Yeah. And then the way they turn it on its head, it really like, bravo, that I ended up hating Ebel after this scene, which is exactly what they intended.
Very, very letter from a Birmingham jail there, Dr. King bemoaning the white moderates who are no friend to the African American at all. But it is, yeah, like that's I think the real knife twist in the moment is that you think, you know, oh, we're gonna get a happy ending here, as happy ending as you can see in a gangster movie, and then Ebel just fucking and does it in the most shit eating way possible. Like the way he dismisses Loy, I was offended. You know, like the guy, he's like Joe Bulo goes and just gets his drink. Like, okay, you're not. We're withdrawing our courtesy and hospitality. Get the fuck out now. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus.
And that anger that Chris Rock displays when
there's
this happens.
Nothing you can do. You can do.
It immediately just turns to being resigned to the situation. Like you can see, you know, on his face,
it takes
it's
a chunk
like,
out of him. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and he only gets that. He only gets any bit of that chunk back when he sees his family later, which is then immediately taken from him again. It's a brutal episode for him.
I think that's a nice connection to his debate with Lemuel earlier, where they're talking about, you know, safety versus power. You can't have both, and like, you know, I thought that's where they were going with, like, oh, well, this is kind of like the one gangster movie where, and fittingly, it's not by his choice. He has to give up power, and now maybe his family is going to be safer and happier. You know, like, let the other people. I'm just going to keep my head down and do my job and let the other people sweat the deed. But nope, the past catches up with him, and Zalmair's there to stab him to death, which is infuriating because she's such a agent of chaos, and she's, you know, like, if Loy plays the game the way it's supposed to be played, she's just completely coloring outside the lines and shooting baskets outside of the from out of bounds, and, you know, coming there and stabbing him. And then Satchel being the one, he's sitting there reading How to Win Friends and Influence People, and he hears some scuffling on the, he goes out there just in time to see Zalmair shush him and his dad die with like the worst look, a horrified realization. Like, I will say this, Chris Rock put in a death performance, man. I felt that one.
Huh.
I don't know how Mike Milligan gets out of the bed every morning seeing his father's eyes like that.
Yeah, they would be haunting.
Like, holy mo- I thought Wef was going to have a hard life living down the look that Deffy was giving him, but Loy Kanan, man, like, that's... Whoa. Wow. It's amazing. So, yeah, that happens. You know, we gotta mention the oranges everywhere. I thought it was funny in one of these interviews Holly mentioned that, like, I never know what to think of these showrunners, whether they're taken at his word. He says the oranges had no connection to Godfather. They were designed in the truck scene to be this juxtaposition of this orange, bright, sunny Florida fruit that's hiding, you know, bad stuff going on in this frozen Midwestern tundra, which is also correct. You know, like, that's not all tracks, but also it's like got this long history of gangster, and like Loy dies with the sack of oranges. Go, like, this is God. This whole episode is very Godfather.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, really, Holly, you didn't know about the orange thing?
Well, this is tracking now. This makes sense. Why would they have a gangster assassination scene where they ask him to, you know, talk about how he killed his father, one of the mafia dons? Why would they have, you know, a Joe Bulo who takes you out to the woods to kill you and then ask if you have any last request? It's because Noah Hawley hasn't seen any gangster films. Now we know.
Noah Hawley has not seen a single gangster film other than Fargo. Like, he's only seen anything that the Coen brothers have done, and that's it. That's it, though.
It must be true.
But Jesus, he saw Miller's Crossing. That's a pretty good gangster film. I mean, come on.
If you're
stuck in Coen brothers, so.
Yeah.
So we end with this kind of coda of Ethel Rita delivering her history report that she's been working on all season long. You know, history is a form of memory. But what does it mean, the fact that we all have different backgrounds, we all have different histories, our histories are all segregated? You know, what it means to be a white American is not what it means to, well, shit, even what it means to be a white American constantly is flux, you know, like there's a day when Germans and Dutch and Irish and Italians weren't considered Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish people weren't considered Americans. Now they're all roughly kind of white mostly. And what is that? That's separate from the history of black people in America.
And Native Americans,
Native,
which they name check here.
Right. Which is also separated. And, you know, who's writing the history books? Who's the one that, who gets to choose what we remember and what, gets forgotten, which,
yeah,
you know, reminds me a lot of the furor over the New York Times 1619 project, you know, like the recontextualization of American history that they tried to do, centering it around the slave trade and whatnot. Like, people just got really pissed at, like, a factual historical account of the founding of the country.
Oh, wow.
You know, but that fucks up a lot of people's agendas and a lot of people's worldviews and stuff, you know, like trying to, you know, the revisionist history is the thing that, like, is seen as factual, and the actual history that's like, oh, actually, we've done a lot more research and we've got a lot more perspectives and this is the real thing, that's now trying to seen as revisionist history. So I also read the Holly...
Well, it's all shot over Ebel, sort of sitting at the desk, right, with his fingers, you know, together and looking like the Mafia Don, and he's the one now writing this particular history, right?
Right. And then, so I guess Holly was supposed to suggest, with Ethel Rita sitting in front of this summary execution by the Moorish kings, this French painting in this fancy office. I took it as that she might have taken over. Like, I'm like, man, maybe her and Lemuel had a relationship. Maybe they don't. Maybe she took over Loy Cannon's business. Maybe she's doing this. I guess Holly was supposed to suggest that she went to that her bags suggested she went to France for some kind of highfalutin education curating thing, and she's in sitting in front of the original painting for some reason. She didn't find a way to integrate in America. She just escaped it.
Okay. And so she's the one obviously telling the history story here.
Right.
Is he trying to say something about, like,
she's doing
the intellectuals are somehow above it and are able to, be objective and tell the true history? Or, like, because I don't know if that's true either. I think everybody's caught in that trap. You know, it's a matter of perspective. She's telling what she saw of this story.
Yeah.
But I didn't pick that up the first time through. It was only after I saw it mentioned on Reddit that, like, this about this painting, and then I started, like, thinking back. Oh, right, no, she's in France there. It didn't connect with me on first watch at all.
Mm-hmm. And then, if you missed it, there's a post-credit scene. There's about 10 seconds of credits, and then we get Mike Milligan. They got Bakeem Woodbine back to film. I guess they filmed like 30, 40 minutes of new material and only used this, which explains the shortness of the episode and some of the pacing issues of the other throughout the other season. But it's Mike Milligan driving around the Kitchen Brothers, or at least one of them. He's checking his gun. He's thinking back to his youth in split screen. He's very pensive, you know. And that was, I guess, cool.
Yeah, I'm trying to think when... When is this taking place? Like, he's, because you can see, like, the Kitchen Brother who's left, and I can't remember their names, has, like, the cuts under his eyes. So it's like after some serious action. I'm just trying to remember season two, and I really can't remember that.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, like, if it is, like, you're supposed to understand, is like this after he got busted down to the desk job, is this on his way to, you know, thinking he's going to get the rewards?
Maybe.
You know, like, it's after the main events of Fargo season two, but before he actually gets to the actual ending. I don't know, but I guess there was, like, you know, this whole series of scenes that was set in the 90s. Around what Mike Milligan was doing, and they brought Bakeem Woodbine out here, and they shot all these scenes, and then Holly's like, this just isn't working. This is very, you know, Return of the Kingy, where, like, where is this coming from? And he said he wrote this, like, amazing speech that, like, kind of summed up the whole, but it just, he never could quite and, you know, Woodbine sounded and looked amazing giving it, but he's just like, it just didn't feel like, it felt like the season's overstaying its welcome. So he ripped it out, which, you know, again, it seems like that's the thing. I haven't got, I still feel like there's a real deep dive post-mortem to be done with Holly. But from what little I've seen, I've already seen that, like, that was the kind of the original sin. Because the other thing I got in these interviews with Holly is that the whole point of season four was, like, the germ of the idea was, oh, how did Mike Milligan get to be in that position in the 70s and that period and that time? And everything worked back to, like, make the ages work and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, telling this tale of immigrants and people of color's history in America and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But it's wild that the core conceit of the thing was kind of screwed up the pacing and caused him to restructure a bunch of stuff. It just, yeah, like I said, it just feels like a cake that didn't quite bake.
Yeah, that happens. It's just a shame when it happens on this scale, right? You spend all this money, all this time, and then the thing just doesn't come together at the end. Oof.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's Fargo season four. Had its ups, had its downs, had its great moments. Had some things that, mm-hmm. you know, I was just going to stick with me for a long time, but the parts were greater than the whole, I think, for sure. And that's a damn shame.
And that is what I'll remember of this season. I'll remember things like the fart attack. I'll remember things like the massacre in the train station. I'll remember things like Gaetano dancing on the ice, right? Stupid stuff like that. I don't think I've taken away enough of what the season wanted me to take away.
Yeah. And that, you know, the other thing is like, there's this was somewhat of a cursed project. It had a pandemic that shut it down that caused them to, you have to do that we talked about that 4-month flash forward that kind of sort of broke some story things, was forced on them because there's no more snow. I don't know if we talked about that last scene, but someone I tweeted or emailed me that, like, the you know, one of the problems was, like, when you have when they came back and do filming, there's no more snow on the ground, so you have to go to spring, which kind of, like, helped out some things, hurt other things. They had to recast Zellmer and Swanee from the beginning. They were going to go with Amber Midthunder and the woman that played Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black, Uza Aduba, I think is her name. I forget why that fell through, but they had to recast them right before the things, and they shot this. They brought Woodbine back to do all this shooting to kind of really tie into Mike Milligan, and that didn't. It just feels like he just had problems all over the place.
Yeah,
you know, that led to pacing problems, which made him chop up the middle of the season, which made that very uneven. It's just it didn't quite go all his way, and that's a shame. But I'm glad he did it. I'm glad, like I said, I'm much rather see a guy swing for the fences and miss than, you know, bunt all day long.
Sure, and I'd be in for season five if they ended up doing one. I would definitely be watching it.
That's the amazing thing about all the anthologies. You know, I'll put American Horror Story up there too. It's like, you know, season great, season terrible. Next season, it's like sports. Well, there's always next season.
Sure.
You know,
right.
So we'll have to see how Fargo does in the draft. He said in both of these interviews that he has a clear idea for season five.
Okay.
But he doesn't think it's going to be his next project. I guess he's got a book that's been overdue for 2 years that he's going to try to write and some other things. But yeah, he's already got a season five of Fargo, which is more than we had at the end of season three. If you'll recall, in season three, he's like, I mean, I'm not opposed to doing more Fargo, but I have no idea what to do with Fargo at this point. So,
yeah, I do wonder how big the idea for season five is. You know, is he going to go for another kind of big analysis of something, you know, that's plaguing the world? Or is he going to take it smaller again and do something more personal, like a season one sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting because he always says, like, he doesn't like to, or if he's trying to talk about current events, he likes to do it in the context of the past, which I think is a really smart move, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, history repeating itself over and over, there's an endless possibility to do that, sure.
Plus, it's at a remove. You know, it's one thing to be, like, up in arms about stuff happening today, but, like, you know, if you set something, you know, if you want to do some kind of parallel to today through the lens of Vietnam, well, you know, like, we've got 40 years 50 years on from the fact of like passions have cooled. We've kind of like, you know, been able to see who's right and who's wrong historically. I think it's a really good idea to tell these stories. And like I said, I'd be in for season five. I'm curious to see. I haven't been keeping track of like how well this show has been doing, like in ratings wise. It's probably a little bit harder to tell now that it's an FX Hulu type of thing. But the other question is like, is FX Studios, are they going to renew season five for, Fargo?
Yeah.
Maybe things we consider next week, because we are going to have a wrap up podcast. Yeah. I imagine it depends on how long it is going to be, depends on how much feedback we get on it. Because I'm going to do a little bit more kicking around on the Holly postmortems and stuff. And I might have some more things after I read some more and think about it a bit. But we're definitely going to do it next week. Fargo@baldmove.com is how you get that feedback into me. Here's a sample of what we got this week.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Fargo@baldmove.com. First up is Diabetes Man.
Oh, boy.
It's probably not his real name unless it's Wilford Brimley back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he says, Noah Hawley's writing in a lot of ways reminds me of Nick Pizzolatto, the creator and writer of True Detective, in the sense that they get a basic story idea that is clear as you're watching it, that they are more interested in that than the story itself. Nick has said that if he could, he'd just write a story where two guys drive around in a car and have conversations. But he couldn't sell that, so he made a detective story as well. In the same way, even though this season is a mob war, it's clear Noah Hawley wasn't interested in the war part of the story, but more so a season about immigration and assimilation. So I get why people get frustrated with both writers and why some people aren't feeling the season of Fargo. I've been in the True Detective fandom, and people often get frustrated with the seasons as well, especially the infamous season two, and often have similar reactions to that show. I'm enjoying it myself, and I see what Noah's going for most of the time, so I can forgive any missteps. I mean, I largely agree. It's just I think it's a bad idea to give short shrift to the meat of the story, to like, you know, or the sizzle. Like, if the steak is the immigration and what it means to be an American and assimilation and the American dream, and if it's a fair shot, then, you know, that's the steak. That's a lot of chewing. Why do you chew it? Because of the sizzle. Because it, you know, I 100% agree with this piece of feedback. It's just really frustrating, because if you nail the gang war and have everyone talking about how amazing a crime story, more people are going to watch it and more people are going to get the message that you're trying to deliver. Whereas if it's this weird esoteric morality play. You know, people are going to be like, ah, this is more social justice bullshit infecting my television. Click, you know.
Yeah.
Why would you make it that easy to dismiss? Why wouldn't you try to wrap it into the most delicious Sabo that you could, you know, so it effectively penetrates the target?
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, like, you know, that comparison is apt. I think it's the structure of those is why I'm willing to keep giving both of these shows a chance. Like, you know, Fargo season 4 doesn't hit the mark quite. True Detective season 2 didn't come anywhere close, in my opinion.
Sure.
And yet I went back for a third helping of True Detective. I will go back for a fifth helping of Fargo if it shows up. So
yeah,
there's something about like the anthology format that lets those people do what they do in a way where they can miss the mark every once in a while, and it's still okay to do that.
G. Salmon says, I think fans were thrown for a loop at the two primary mob figures cast this season being famous comedian actors. But after getting through almost the entire season now, I believe it was very intentional on Holly's part. It was clearly intentional with Josto, as he was demonstrated that he's just a silly kid who happened to fall into power through nepotism and has only maintained it through sheer blind luck and more nepotism. I think that Schwartzman playing this role could actually be one of the more brilliant castings in Fargo, as maybe the audience wasn't supposed to believe that Schwartzman could be a mob boss this entire time, just like Ebel never has and Gaetano and Kalmita didn't until they disappeared and Gaetano mistaked Josto's blind stupidity for an intelligent strategy. Those around him in the show never believed that Josto had what it takes to be a mob boss, and the audience didn't believe that Schwartzman had what it takes to play a mob boss. Rapid de Pilario. I butchered that, but you know, double it. I don't know if Holly was thinking on this level, but it would surprise me for him to be so undeliberate in his casting choices when he's generally knocked it out of the park in past seasons, even with relatively unknown actors.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem, though. Like, you know, Fargo has no shortage of buffoonery when it comes to crime bosses and criminals in general. So, like, that's all defensible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I'll say, maybe that's it.
This is an American Sad story, and it's unsatisfying as fuck.
Sure.
It's not a meritocracy. The good guys don't win. The good guys are often bad guys. Like, there is no justice.
There is no, that's just not something built into the fabric of this place.
But it's really frustrating to watch, you know, because you want that to happen.
I did like settle into Jason Schwartzman as the season went on. Definitely, like at the beginning, I was like, oh, I don't know if this is working for me. Here, I wasn't thinking like, I have problems with his death scene and all that stuff. But I wasn't thinking, oh, Schwartzman is not doing this right, like I was early on.
I still think Gaetano, man, like I can see why people like this guy. And I definitely saw moments where it's like, oh, this guy, this could have been a different thing. But, you know, and I still don't know why Josto at the end is. I mean, it's like I said, this is Sonny and Fredo running the organization. And that's not satisfying either. You know, like watching Sonny drive the old man's business into the ground in the second act of Godfather was very unsatisfying. But what are you going to do?
Sure. I'm not saying it's a satisfying character. I'm saying that he fell into the character they were portraying eventually for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Lastly, I couldn't see until the ending of Happy that they may have actually been doing what they did to Schwartzman this season to Chris Rock as well. Lloyd Cannon delivered some meaningful words this season, but they did kind of did lack a true and convincing tone behind them. It could have been because they miscast him. It could have been that they were actually trying to show someone who wasn't actually tough, but just looked like it because he's surrounded by tougher men. In the last scene, Cannon had lost at least 27 men and seemingly lost his only help from Happy. And he's talking about not having half the strength of Buell when he's at his best, how he just bought a painting to make him look tough without actually having any insider knowledge behind it. He said earlier in the season when he's trying to sell credit cards that people just wanted to look rich. This may be a callback to that and that he was speaking the truth both times. People want to look rich even when they aren't. Mob bosses want to look tough even when they aren't. And that has been the case with the two primary bosses we followed this season. Both Rock and Schwartzman can pretend to be tough, but they're just comedian actors trying to portray something that the public may be incapable of perceiving them as because of their frame as comedians. Cannon and Fada can both act tough, but they're not tough themselves. Only the people around them are. Just an interesting little side discussion, in my opinion, is why these two were cast. Like, you know, it's just, like, that all makes really good intellectual sense. Just like, I think someone, like, last week, we provided a brilliant defense of what they were trying to do with Gaetano. It's just, I don't like it. It wasn't fun to watch, you know?
I'm thinking back on the performances, and like Chris Rock, when he needed to be, you know, when he needed to look like a badass, I think mostly convinced me. Like I'm 99% of the way there on Chris Rock being a smart, tough, you know, gangster. But like, I got there on both of those characters. I got there on Chris Rock because he convinced me through the performance that he was the character that I didn't think that actor could be. And then Josto, as Schwartzman's Josto, convinced me that he was the actor that they meant that character to be. You know, it's like they were different, like they had different trajectories of how I came to terms with those characters, but I eventually did with both of them. And you're right, like saying, okay, well, this painting just makes him look like a badass and all the other things that make him look like it. You're right, that's there. And maybe that went into the casting. I just, by the end of it, I was convinced that Loy Cannon was a badass. He was just not in the position to overtake these other badasses.
Anyway, thanks for that. Graham H. also, he was the first to send me the IndieWire and Hollywood Reporter articles I've been talking about, the interviews with Noah Hawley, so I appreciate that. Saves me a little bit of time for beating the streets myself. Josh M. says, I've been thinking for weeks that it makes no sense for Weff to betray Josto. Cannon had no dirt on him that would force him to what was stopping Weff going straight back to the Italians and planting a trap on Cannon and the crew. Is this just another mishap of criminals being dumb this season, or am I missing something? I don't. I mean, the thing you're missing, I guess, is that everyone is watching everyone. Like, except for maybe the Italians. I actually think the smart play for him was to back Cannon, because I thought Cannon looked like he was the one that had the better chance of winning. But, you know, Weff is a mess. Like, his whole arc was he's a person out of control. Can't control his body, can't control his mind. Seeks to look to have that control so that he can have, master himself a little bit and just constantly losing it. And by the end, he just... You know, like I think the other thing you might be missing is I do think that Weff at the end was trying to go like straight. Mm-hmm. Like he was trying to he's trying to be the policeman that Deffy wanted him to be as way to atone and, you know, leading all these raids and beating all the sides. And it was just too late. Like if he had always done that, it'd been fine.
Yeah.
But a dirty cop trying to wash himself, you know, wash his hands in a fountain of blood just isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Ferconda from New York says, when Josto kills his future father-in-law, the alderman, and Dr. Harvard, he's in essence killing off the deniers of the new immigrants. The alderman looked down on Josto and the Italians. Dr. Harvard denied them entry into his pristine hospital. In essence, killing them off is proof that the Italian immigrants are becoming part of the fabric of American life. They have crossed the threshold of the other.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, dovetails with Ebel becoming the conglomerate, right, that runs, that goes nationwide.
They continue, what a strange sort of ending to a series I love and a season I loved even more. I'm going to miss turning on to the show and the episodes as you podcast, which are the highlight of my week. And I have some more thoughts from moments of the show. I hope we don't harsh your enjoyment of the season and the episode, because everybody, you know, you get to love what you love. We love season three. A lot of people hate it.
Yeah,
we,
it's just like my opinion, man.
Had a lot of problems with season two, which a lot of people think is the best. So, you know, we are all Fargo radicals here. We accept all radical Fargo opinions, tubular ones, gnarly ones, all the surfer adjectives. When Abel reneges on his deal with the Cannons, it's reflective of how blacks have been treated in America. Even their freedom from slavery was reneged on. It was not what this was promised to them. We are not taking half. We are leaving you with half. This moment is painful to watch. For all his cunningness and stealth, Roy could never get ahead. The game is rigged to him from the start. The way he screams and then slumps in his chair, similar to when he pulls over and sees the billboard for the Diners Club.
Yeah, for sure.
No, it's really good. And, you know, you're not wrong. Like, you know, Dr. Senator had his own story of like the okie doke they pulled on black people in World War One. And that's a consistent pattern. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, if you fight our wars, then you come back and, you know, you can earn your freedom. You can get your 40 acres and a mule, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, shit. You know, don't have the funding for that. Fuck. Ah, we're going to let the KKK take over. Well, you know, better luck the next 40 year civil rights struggle. It's been a you know, Lucy and fucking Charlie Brown football situation for generations. The oranges represent mortal death in The Godfather, of course. Loy is carrying the harbingers of doom in his arms as he wistfully looks at his family. He seems to be content to be a company man now, if it can afford him time to be with his family. And the smile on his face is beautiful until... Agreed. Like I said, that's the scene that really fucked with me, because I thought they were going to kill him, and then it turns out they weren't, and then I thought he was going to get the, you know, essentially American Gangster plus ending of surviving and keeping his family and keeping a measure of his importance and power and wealth, and they took it all from him. God damn it. Ethel Reader writes, who writes the books, who chooses to get remembered and what gets forgotten? This Fargo season, we got to hear/see the tale of another type of family, which is a rarity in the TV storytelling landscape. I applaud Holly for taking this narrative on. It wasn't even, but it was a hell of a ride. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, I guess, is as someone who tries to put a neat little bow on where we're at and the progress we try to make as Americans, it is a very hard thing to do, to both like maintain a positive outlook toward the future and a full reconciliation and accounting of the past. It's just... Man, we're still in the fucking thick of it. Noah Hawley, the guy who did The Leftovers that we like so much, and Lost, and The Watchmen.
Damon Lindelof.
Taking pokes at this stuff is very admirable, because enormous risks, very little reward. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm glad we keep trying, because that's how we muddle through. That's how we wrestle through with this.
Yeah. It feels like the stuff, you've got to walk a mile to gain an inch, and the miles just keep coming. Like I don't think we're ever going to get past any of this, right? It's going to be an eternal struggle. It's going to be something that just changes and morphs, you know, how we have to deal with it. You know, people will always want power. There will always be greed. There will always be reasons for people to step on each other's necks. I don't know that you ever get that you get everybody on the planet to agree on anything, let alone everything.
Yeah, we got this playlist of Christmas music, and I got Stevie Wonder's One Day at Christmas Time. I think that's the name of the song, but it's essentially... him recording a song about, and he's trying to tackle everything, like racism, but like, and prejudice, and even war. Like, you know, one day there'll be a planet where we have a Christmas where there's no one at war, and there's no one that's hungry, and there's no one that's homeless, and there's no one to hate someone because of the creed or the religion or the race. And like, every time I've heard it two or three times this year already, and every time I'm thinking like, damn, Mr. Wonder, you are biting off a whole hell of a lot. You get this feeling that, like, you know, you solve one problem, you're going to have still the others. And like, if you get, you know, in many ways, we here in the United States are kind of like the leading edge of some of this like melting pot stuff and, you know, multiculturalism. And, you know, if we solve it in this country, then there's stuff around the world to worry about.
Yeah, it's funny. This is this tribalism. Maybe this is why I brought it up, but the tribalism is like a huge aspect of the latest Expanse books I've been reading. I'm in book 6. They're just like, they started off that series with these mega tribes, right? Of Earth and Mars and the Belt. And they were all their own individual tribes, those three. And then the story of the Expanse has just been a progressive microcosming of all of that and showing these micro tribes, right? Where in these larger factions, you still have people who don't agree on anything. and they all have like the same interest, and they all have like a goal they should be working together toward, and they can't because they're all fucking at each other's throats over their own petty, like small disagreements on how things should be run, and nobody can get their shit together.
And it's not, and it's not like even it's not a racial thing now. It's like because like that's one of the big things. Expanse is everyone's got like, you know, their physical presentation, like whether they're mostly like Asian or African or European descent. They might have a Russian name or an Asian name or a French name. Mm-hmm. Like everything's like been mixing and mixing. It's all about like whether you were, you know, did you grow up in a gravity well or not? Did you grow up on Earth or Mars if you're in a gravity well? It's weird because like, you know, you got Star Trek that shows 400 years in the future, we've solved all the problems.
Right.
And Expanse, which is 400 years in the that we've just played shell games with all the problems. Uh-huh.
I feel like the Expanse outcome is more likely.
The fact that, I don't know, like are we all just doomed to repeat 80-year cycles of history? Like, you know, like once the old folks that died off the last time remembered, like, do we slide steps back? I mean, I don't know. It seems like we've made progress.
And that's the thing. You know, I do see that there is progress being made. And also, like, losing your faith, I guess, like, adopting that cynicism and just saying, well, fuck it, if that's how it's going to be, then none of this matters and I'm going to get mine, is the path that leads to that very outcome that you're decrying, right? So you've got to avoid cynicism, and you've got to keep the hope alive in order to make any progress whatsoever. Otherwise, it's just, you know, gangsters going at each other and killing where we need to kill each other.
It's gangsters all the way down, and that's living outside the law of the social compact is not for me anyway.
No.
Rai Rai writes in, says, I'm well known in my circles as being having a perverse love of grief porn. I imagine you're a big fan of the Leftovers. If not, oh boy, have I got a show for you. Oh, here you go. As much as I love the oppressive sadness caused by art such as The Leftovers, my absolute favorite is art that is depressing without actually trying to be, such as this final episode of this season of Fargo. It's a super bummer to know that there are actually people in this world who can live without thought. Shooting a couple of people in the head and putting them in a hole and not batting an eye. It's a super bummer that those with power can do whatever they want and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And my God, the look on the face of Jason Schwartzman when he's walking to his execution and that death face that Chris Rock summons, brutal and beautiful. I mean, Fargo does that well. Like, I remember back in the first season when wasn't a Wrench in Numbers slide that guy conscious into the upside down and through the ice hole cutting the lake and just like like Johnny Cash says, like, God, why do you give us all this power and we're such base shits, you know, like that. Yeah, like everything, thinking about like trying to talk your way out of getting shot and thrown into a ditch. And it's rough if you got some empathy.
Absolutely. And you know, you hate to see it. I do think when I look at all this, I feel like the real power, the true power that people have is in consensus, is in unity and agreement. And it just so happens that the people who are in power, let's not forget the small, vast minority that are in power, have essentially stopped us from coming together to squash that power. Because if we were united as whatever, proletariat, as people who are not racist, whatever, if we came together and said, no, fuck this, our power is in our unity and we're telling you to stop and we're going to make you stop, you could easily overcome whatever power of like money or guns or whatever that those small minority have, right? You could.
Right.
You absolutely could. So the real power there is in consensus, and we just don't have any right now.
And that goes back to the grief porn, because if you read anything about like people, like that's the thing about, it's depressing about reading stuff about, you know, class consciousness, race consciousness, going back and read civil rights stuff, going back and read previous revolution. Everyone independently has this realization over generations that, like, you know what, we're all mostly good and we want the same things.
Yeah.
If we can just like put aside the differences and get rid of the bastards, we'll be. And yet, you know, for hundreds and hundreds and thousands, millennia, epochs of time, we're still locked in these fucking games, man. Yeah.
But that's why you got to keep that hope, right? Because every person who becomes a cynic and says I'm gonna get mine is another person who's not united in those causes.
Like Stevie said, one day at Christmas, It's going to happen. What? Maybe too late for you and me, but one day it's going to happen. My only gripe from this episode, according to Rai Rai, is that Mike Milligan didn't pass a decaying "the future is now" billboard at the end of the show. Wouldn't that have been cool?
Oh, like, yeah.
One
yeah,
of the last shots, he drives by the future, and it's all just peeling, and you can barely make it out, and like that would have been cool.
I like to think it got cut. He was actively talking while giving that long speech, and they just had to cut it.
Yusuf is our last email of the week. Again, we're going to have one more episode, a wrap-up episode, if you'd like to send your final thoughts to Fargo at baldmove.com. And I know, I would like to hear, let's continue the argument, we've advanced ours, if you see some flaws in it. That's the thing, is I don't even think it's more of like, yeah, this shit's depressing. this isn't entertainment. Yusuf says, hey, Jim and Aaron, I've loved your coverage of Fargo, as always. Thank you very much. This is not a plot-related theory or anything. It's just something I found interesting. I feel like Boardwalk Empire had a few good fingers poking around in Noah Hawley's brain when he was forming his vision for the season as far as a vibe. Loy Cannon specifically felt very reminiscent of Nucky Thompson. I've kept that thought to myself since I didn't really think it means anything, but I decided to share it with you guys, especially once Aaron started describing Loy Cannon as a decent guy by criminal reckonings. He holds the code. He keeps his word. He doesn't have these really intense, crazy plots. To me, that's Nucky in a nutshell. When you factor in Cannon's life as a mob boss and how pragmatic he is about everything, his lounging style, his setup at the hotel he lived in for the last episodes, it's just very eerily similar to Nucky when he lived at the Ritz. And the similarities definitely jumped out to me, too. This quote in an interview with Holly also made things connect further in my head, which is, this is from the True Hollywood Reporter, or the Hollywood Reporter. I don't think true or false has anything to do with it. The more power he pushes for, the less safe he and his family become. At this critical moment, they're the least safe they will ever be. And once his business has been taken from him and been made into an employee, he goes home and looks in the window and has a moment to realize that he's safe. Yeah. He thinks maybe this was winning on some level. And the tragedy is this, of course, is his moment of death. In Nucky's case, the hunger was more for money rather than power, although those things are famously somewhat coupled. Mm-hmm. In the series finale, he ends up losing all of his business to the New York Mafia, but still has enough money to live comfortably, and he has rekindled his relationship with his previously estranged wife, and in return may have his family back. He feels lucky to be alive and ready to start the rest of his life when, boom, betrayal from his past comes back to end his life. Oh, shit, I forgot about that. There's a ton of Loy Cannon in this, if you ask me. I tend to agree. I tend to agree with what you're laying down here, Yusuf.
Yeah.
You also mentioned early in the season how Gaetano Fada reminded you of Bobby Cannavale's character, Gyp Rossetti. And then, of course, there's a more direct connection in the casting of Jack Houston, the one, the only Mr. Richard Harrow, someone we barely have seen in anything on a major network since Boardwalk Empire. Don't get me wrong, the guy's an acting beast, but how does anybody remember him unless they were fresh out of a Boardwalk Empire binge? Yeah, and he plays another scarred veteran that has trouble reintegrating with society in any kind of normal way.
He's like a Gary Oldman, where he's this chameleon who can change everything about him, everything about his performance from role to role, and yet he hasn't gotten that attention that Gary Oldman did. And he's still pretty young, so give him time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And he does show up from time to time. I always like seeing him. I can't remember all the things I've seen him in, but he still does a lot of character work. And, that is what he's really good at, just subsuming himself, because he's a very good-looking guy, very talented, but he's always playing these weirdos where he's contorting his voice or his face or his mannerisms to be off-putting and, being this outsider. But goddamn, I do love Richard Harrow. If you're feeling up for a real strong gangster story, you could do a lot worse than, what is it, 4 seasons, 5 seasons of Boardwalk Empire?
At least 5, yeah.
And Richard Harrow is, if you like Wef, wait till you get a load of fucking Richard Harrow. Holy shit. I don't think he shows up till season 2, maybe. But goddamn, one of my favorite all-time characters. Right up there with Omar Little as all-time favorite, super cool backstory badasses in television fictional history.
Is there something about TV that makes it harder for actors to get recognized? Because you're on a show for a long time. right?
Yeah, you're locked in that contract, yeah.
Right, and so if people aren't watching the show that you're on, or if, like, people... you know, you just get talked about in the same way over and over and over for years at a time, whereas Gary Oldman, you know, jumping around movie to movie to movie, it affords people a lot of opportunities to see you and be impressed with your work, whereas television, whew, if you don't get somebody from the beginning, it's really hard to get them invested. Like, I feel like Breaking Bad is one of those exceptions where the audience grows, but typically audiences for TV shows shrink as they go.
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, there's always that, like, small screen, big screen, like, you know, prejudice in Hollywood. I feel like that's been less of the golden era,
yeah,
but now you got a worse problem. Now it's like high school football, college football, professional football. You've got such a huge farm team now with all these amazing prestige dramas with these huge casts that, like, what they all can't break. I mean, look at Game of Thrones. Who is going to be the breakout star from there?
Peter
it might
Dinklage,
be nobody.
Because he already was.
He already was a star. But, yeah, like, you look at Kit Harington, he's tried to do some things. You look at Richard was Rob Stark, he tried to do.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying they don't have a career. You know, Emilia Clarke. I'm not saying that they haven't, but, like, it doesn't seem like they're able to catch that fire. And what we're like, it, and if you think any one of them is going to do it, what's the odds that 10 people break out of that show? You know?
Yeah, I mean,
it's just really hard.
Like I said, Breaking Bad, like Bryan Cranston, you know, Aaron Paul tried to break out, and I don't think he successfully has. Like, he's got a career, but it's not the super high profile. Bryan Cranston even has had a hard time, even though he's an incredible actor and everyone loves him. It's honestly a genre defining performance from him.
Yep.
Like, he's in movies, but I don't think he's been in any movies that have really, like, gone over the top and put him at the movie star level.
He's got a new, I think, limited miniseries. It might be on HBO where he's a judge. I just saw that talking about. He's definitely. But your point stands. Like, for every high school star athlete, you know, the star quarterback on your high school team that everybody loves and wants to be is going to be maybe a wide receiver on a Division III college team, and he's going to wash out of the pros or not even get a sniff. Like, you know, I feel like that's with all these different television all happening in different networks and different, and like, we're so fragmented. Like, having one iconic role might be like, yeah, that's the career. It's like we have a string of one hit wonders, and the people that become super duper stars. And not that it's less frequent. It's just that there's only so many roles we have for people, and you know. In the movies anyway, and there's always people trying to break in, so it's a dog-eat-dog world. Gangster. Very gangster out in Hollywood.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
You think the mouse plays around? Fuck no. You're going to wake up in a goddamn ditch, you fuck with that rat. That's a pretty good place to stop the podcast, I think. We will be back next week to kind of wrap things up. You know, like I said, we advanced a lot of arguments. I know you guys did too. If you want to get your last words in, I'm more than open to intellectually discussing the show. I'm going to kick around and see if I can get some more interviews with Holly and see what other people are saying. But we'll be back for one more episode next week. Fargo at baldmove.com is how you get that feedback in. Stop by our forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you'd like to see some discussion there. And of course, you can follow us on at Bald Move on Twitter if you want to keep up with the latest. Subscribe. Hey, if you want to make sure you don't miss a Bald Move podcast, look for Bald Move Pulp, Bald Move Prestige. Subscribe for those. That's where everything goes. You know, pulpy is where the comic booky and spacey stuff and the fantasy stuff goes. Prestige is kind of everything else. A great way to stay connected with us. But we'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.